From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, he helped write the nation's fuel economy standards. Now he's speaking out against the Trump administration's plan to weaken the standards.
All the objective evidence is if they're working, and when they're working, you know, why roll them back?
Crowns of Courage, elaborate henna tattoo crowns for women living with cancer.
You know, it was so special because it was the first time in a long time that I had felt beautiful.
Detroit-based journalist Charlie LaDuff talks about his latest book.
I have a lot of respect for public officials who do the job well and do it hard and don't do it to enrich themselves or their contributors.
And a new play explores a woman's dementia.
So as the dementia increases, the play is written from the standpoint of what is going on inside her head.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They've spent years working for the EPA. Now hundreds of former EPA employees are speaking out across the country and speaking out loudly, demanding the Trump administration back off of its plan to weaken national fuel economy standards aimed at reducing car emissions. They call themselves the Environmental Protection Network. And two of the EPN members testified against the Trump plan at an EPA public hearing today in Dearborn, including Jeff Olson, a former senior policy advisor at the EPA. He worked there for 40 years, and he spent some 10 years writing the EPA fuel economy standards. Jeff Olson, the very rules that acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler is now trying to roll back?
Yes, that's correct, Cindy.
That must be surreal for you as you stand at a hearing before your former employer speaking out about your opposition to an action it wants to take that would unwind the work you did.
It is. And it's not just that it was the work that I did, but it's also that these standards have been, I think the objective evidence shows, very successful. We've been reducing car pollution, especially the greenhouse gas pollution that leads to global warming and climate change. Consumers have been getting higher fuel economy, so they're saving money, that they're, you know, more money in their pockets and less money going to the oil companies. And the thing that I think a lot of people forget to mention, the automakers are actually doing great under these standards. Because consumers love these cars, they are a little bit more expensive because it takes new technology to meet these standards, to be sure. But they're saving so much on gasoline that they're flocking into showrooms. And the last 3 years have been three of the four best selling years in U.S. automotive history. So profits are up, jobs are up, UAW supports the standards. So because of that, you know, this isn't some theoretical thing that we're doing in the future. These standards have been getting a little more stringent each year since 2012, and I think all the objective evidence is if they're working, and when they're working, you know, why roll them back?
So just to bring everybody onto the same page, the Trump administration announced last month it wants to freeze U.S. mileage standards at levels that were mandated by President Obama for 2020. And these standards are the ones that regulate just how far vehicles must travel on a gallon of fuel. So, Jeff, what do you believe would result from changing existing fuel economy standards for model years 2021 through 2026?
We will emit a lot more greenhouse gas pollution. Will emit more health-related emissions as well, although the standards are greenhouse gas standards, but it turns out that when you make a car more efficient, you also generally make the car a little cleaner for health-related pollution as well. Consumers will have less efficient cars, so they'll have to pay more, you know, out of their pocket for gasoline to drive around every day and every year. And I feel that the automakers themselves will lose their leadership position right now because these standards have been driving a lot of innovation. That's why these standards can be so good from an economic standpoint. They help spark the type of technology innovation that, you know, where auto industry engineers can use their ingenuity and their skills to come up with better ways to do what they used to do. the U.S. right now is in a very good spot. The U.S. companies are among the best technology companies in the world. If we cut back on these standards while the Chinese and the Europeans and the Japanese continue to set more and more stringent standards, I'm afraid we're going to lose that technology leadership, and that could have a big impact on the health and well-being of our domestic industry 5 and 10 and 20 years from now.
Then there's this issue of California. Jeff, how easy would it be for Congress to revoke California's waiver to set its own standards and the other states that are setting their own standards?
Well, Congress, of course, can do whatever they want to do, whatever they want to do. This is a little different. This would be the EPA revoking the waiver that we granted to the state of California a few years ago. Under this proposal from the Trump administration, EPA would be revoking that waiver. That's never happened. That's unprecedented. And so the legal questions are up in the air as to whether a court would decide that after 50 years of granting waivers to the state of California and never revoking one, does EPA actually have the right and the power to revoke a waiver that is already granted? So that's a very uncertain question, but it's not really a congressional question. Congress could always pass a law, Cindy, and change the Clean Air Act and say California no longer has the ability to ask for a waiver, but that hasn't happened. The law still allows California to ask for that waiver. And so this is a kind of a question more for the Trump administration, for the EPA itself, as to whether they want to try to revoke that waiver. I'll just say briefly, I think it would be a real mistake to do that, because when you look back 50 years, the U.S. has been the most successful country in the world in reducing vehicle pollution. Let me put a shameless plug in. Because of the laboratory in Ann Arbor that many of your listeners probably drive by every day on Plymouth Road, we have the world's leading, I say we, because even though I retired EPA, I still think of myself as an EPA person. So the EPA lab on Plymouth Road has been the global leader in reducing vehicle pollution ever since 1970. We were the first country to require catalytic converters. We were the first country to require unleaded gasoline. These are some of the greatest technology, environmental technology innovations of all time. They've saved countless millions of lives and illnesses. And it's been a combination of EPA pushing the way at times, and then other times the state of California leading the way. It's been kind of a synergistic relationship. And there's been debates all along between the industry about whether we were going too fast or not. But when you look back now, in 2018, to what was done back in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, everybody, I mean even the industry, agrees that the technology that these regulations sparked turned out to be successful for everybody, successful for the consumers, successful for the citizens, successful even for the automakers. And I think if we take the California out of that equation, it's going to mean that sometimes when the federal government is run by a president who really doesn't believe in environmental protection, doesn't believe in clean air, doesn't believe in climate change, then there would be no progress. So I think it'd be a real mistake to take California's authority away from them.
I'm speaking with Jeff Alsen, a former senior policy advisor at the EPA. He was there for 40 years. He is no longer with the EPA. He's with the Environmental Protection Network. Members are going around the country testifying against the Trump plan to weaken national fuel economy standards. He spoke at a hearing today in Dearborn. Jeff, when did you leave the EPA?
The end of April of this year.
Okay. So there was consternation among the auto industry when the midterm review of fuel economy standards was sped up towards the end of the Obama administration. Some felt jammed through very quickly. Why was there a rush to do that?
We finalized this. Well, a little bit of semantics. The standards were actually finalized out to 2025 back in 2012, but we did have this midterm review to kind of to do a check-in and to reaffirm, maybe that's the better word, to reaffirm the standards. And the Obama EPA did do that in January of 2017, just a couple of weeks before President Obama left office and President Trump came into office. And I will admit that we sped up the process a little bit. But the good news is...
Why was that, though? Why, when you say you sped up the process, why was that?
Well, we sped it up because we kind of knew what was coming. We feared that under the new administration that it was quite possible that these standards would be wiped off the books without a genuine conclusion of that midterm evaluation. And I think what we're seeing today really kind of reinforces that we were probably right. But the other major point I want to make, Cindy, is that in January 2017, people like me had spent almost a full decade working on these standards, analyzing the technology, looking at all the costs, everything. We had published 10,000 pages of technical analysis. Your listeners can go to the EPA.gov website if they want to peruse any of those 10,000 pages. We had done by far the most, because we knew we were making history. We knew these standards were going to be massive from both an environmental and an economic standpoint, and we threw every smart engineer, an economist, an analyst that we had at this program, and we had done so much work by January 2017 that we knew, we had reaffirmed to ourselves that there was plenty of technology to meet these standards 8 years later, because we were doing this in 2017, we were reaffirming the standards all the way up to 2025. We knew there was already the technology there, and the technology cost had actually come down a little compared to what we had first projected years before when we first set the standards. So we just felt like we knew enough. It wasn't like, you know, once you have technology, Cindy, it doesn't disappear. Once you have a technology that you can make for $100, it's not a year later going to be $200 or $300. That's not the way it works. So we knew, you know, we knew enough in January 17 to know that it made sense to finalize these standards. We did speed up the process because we knew once the new folks came in that they were probably going to not allow kind of a data-driven decision. And I think that, you know, the proposal we're at now, this proposal to freeze the greenhouse gas standards for 8 years and the fuel economy standards for 6 years, I mean, totally freeze them and not require the automakers to do anything for 8 years just shows you what we kind of anticipated was going to be the situation. So I think history has validated our decision, but I understand why the industry feels that we did rush the process, and I would admit we did rush the process a little bit.
Jeff Olson was with the EPA for 40 years. He helped to write the National Fuel Economy Standards that the Trump administration is now looking to weaken. In Dearborn today, speaking out against that action. Jeff, thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cindy. I really appreciate being on the show.
Coming up, we learn what henna tattoos can do for women who are dealing with cancer.
My hair falling out, the nausea, and just for those few hours, I was just able to sit still and relax and just remember who I was again.
That comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And it is time for Theater Talk as we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan, here with some of what's happening on Michigan's professional theater scene. And you say you are extra amped up to talk about these productions. And we are starting one truly ripped from the headlines.
Yeah, this is in Out Visible Theater in Allen Park. It's a very small theater. They have a new works festival each year, each of the last 2 years. And the play that won in 2017 is a new play won by a juried process, and it's called Unsportsmanlike Conduct and Jeff Stolzer. It's about an NFL quarterback who had a tryst in a hotel with a diner waitress. The two part in the morning after a lot of tension over his real intentions. Later, she files a rape charge against the NFL star, alleging she was too intoxicated to give consent. It's a short play, around 75 minutes, and the first part of is the morning after. And then we have the litigation, the courtroom proceedings. The fact that this play was written 2 years ago is and debuted, you know, premiered this past weekend is amazing. It's one of those plays that's going to have you talking afterward on the way home. And this also gives me a little chance to plug one of the up-and-coming theaters in our community, which is Out Visible. It's in Allen Park on Ecorse Road. It's a building that not only serves as a performance space, but also where the theater and music students go for classes. The space only holds about 30 people at a time for each performance. So you're really just a few feet away from the actors. It's a great experience.
And you also are very, very positive about the offerings from the Kickshaw Theater in Ann Arbor. And they're at it again.
Yeah. It's a play called Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And when I tell you about this play, Cynthia, a lot of people I know may say, what a bummer. But let me convince them otherwise. This is a play about a woman's descent into dementia. And one of the things that makes this special is that the casting of this play has literally brought together some of the very best actors in Michigan. Nancy Elizabeth Comer, she plays a woman of a certain age who gives tours of the Wisconsin Concrete Park. And she suddenly finds that she can't remember everything she's talked about dozens and dozens of times. So as the dementia increases, the play is written from the standpoint of what is going on inside her head and what is going on inside the heads of her doctor, her adult children. In other words, the dialogue spoken by the actors is the truth of what they're feeling inside their heads, not what they would normally say under the circumstances. I mean, right down to the thoughts inside Molly's head. She's the protagonist. She's when her mind is working, but it's not connected to what can come out of her mouth. So, but the dialogue you're hearing is what's inside her head.
What she's thinking.
Yes, it's a very powerful one-act play written by Laura Jackman, who's a screenwriter. She had to have gone through this with a parent in order for her to have written it so personally, so on the nose. The show also features Dave Davies, Errol Gribble, Sonia Marquis. These are some of the top actors in the state.
And the intimate size at Kickshaw must work very well to pull the audience into this very emotional material.
Yeah, here again, I mean, Kickshaw's using a sort of rented, leased, borrowed space over on Airport Road in Ann Arbor near the Costco. It's a church, you know, on the weekends. It's used for a church gathering. But the performances are riveting.
Hmm. And now we go to some musical theater, A Little Night Music by Stephen Sondheim at Encore Musical Theater in Dexter. So for those of us who very well know Judy Collins's or Frank Sinatra's recordings of Send in the Clowns, but nothing else, tell us about this play.
So, yeah, as you say, this piece by Stephen Sondheim is known for the one big song. It's set in Sweden at the turn of the 20th century, and it's based on a book by Hugh Wheeler and inspired by a 1955 Ingmar Bergman film called Smiles of a Summer Night. It's about a stage actress, Desiree Armfelt is the character, who's grown weary of both touring and her lover, who, let's just say, he's more brawn than brain. Then her former lover comes into the story, and unbeknownst to him, he's actually the father of her child. And that guy, the father of child, has just married the 18-year-old daughter of one of his best friends. Look, there's humor. There's also melancholy and sweetness is kind of reflected in Send in the Clowns. There's flashes of farce, but it's the Sondheim music that's really the star here.
Well, let's get a little taste of that famous song from A Little Night Music. This is Glynis Johns from the original cast recording.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns.
And just a note about Glynis Johns, talk about a keeper. We baby boomers know her as Mrs. Banks in 1964's Mary Poppins. She is still with us and about to turn 95.
Yeah, she was also in the film version of The Importance of Being Earnest and some other things. She's a grand old dame.
Indeed, she is. And let's just spend a few moments here. I'd love your thoughts on the legacy of David D. Chiara. Of course, he died last week. What did he do for art and culture in Michigan? Where do you begin?
Where do you begin is right. He's known for championing opera, obviously. He's founder of the Michigan Opera Theater. He single-handedly just, you know, willed the renovation of the Detroit Opera House. He's a giant. He's also one of the gentlest men I have ever met. And always had time for new people, you know, which is not always the case when you're someone of that stature. I also want to say, and I find this charming, there's what I would call an upstart opera company called Opera Moto in Detroit. And I happen to know, even, you know, in the past year when he was unwell, he had pancreatic cancer, and they were in like kind of a makeshift space a little bit on Grand Boulevard. David went to see the show. Mm. He was so supportive of, you know, startup companies. And we have this magnificent theater in downtown Detroit, the Opera House. We have a thriving, nationally, you know, recognized opera company in Detroit that was doing great things before Detroit really mm-hmm. started to find itself again. So he's a special man.
Well, you can get the details of all the productions we've talked about very, very easily by going to EncoreMichigan.com and some great words on David DeChiara. David Kiley, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
We love it when we hear from our listeners offering up ideas for stories and people we should cover. And a great tip we got from stateside listener George Bollinger was Crowns of Courage. The art of decorating the body with henna is truly ancient. It goes back thousands of years. The intricate henna tattoos could be applied simply for their beauty, or they can symbolize passages in life. And that's the idea behind Crowns of Courage, celebrating women who are coping with and dealing with and living with cancer by giving them elaborate, beautiful henna tattoo crowns. It began in Grand Rapids as an art prize project in 2016. The creator of Crowns of Courage is henna tattoo artist Amanda Joy Gilbert. And one of the women who've been crowned is breast cancer survivor Becky Richard. And here's our conversation from earlier this year. Amanda, my understanding is you were introduced to henna a number of years ago working with the refugee population in West Michigan?
Yeah, back in 2010, I was working with both the Lutheran Social Services and Bethany Christian Services, actually going to school at the time for intercultural studies. And I met so many different refugees from different parts of the world and different backgrounds, religions, and saw this art on multiple of my friends and I was like, wow, this is a beautiful art form that breaks all cultural boundaries, religious boundaries, and really brings beauty on the skin as well as bringing women together in a powerful way. And I had fallen in love with it. Just I've always loved art and working with other cultures. So,
who taught you to do it?
I actually had taught myself. I just started applying it on myself. I've dealt with anxiety most of my life, so I always went back to art. And using this art form to reconnect with my body and to love myself and to calm myself has been really therapeutic. And so I just continue to practice it on my own and look up designs and start researching it more and more.
And then what gave you this idea of crowning women who are cancer survivors?
Well, was originally trying to get in the hospitals to use it as a form of ministry and healing, and not many got back to me or really knew what it was about. So I had found a salon in Comstock Park called Beautiful You who give free services once a month to cancer patients. So makeup and hair, massage, all that, and met a few women there who had had to shave their heads for the first time. And it's a really emotional thing for them. And to be able to be there and just be a vessel for them to talk with, to do a personalized tattoo on, and then also just to offer a crown that fit them perfectly on their heads. Because when else are you going to have that or be able to do that? Has been really fun.
And then in the process, I know people wind up with you photograph your crowned survivors. What kind of experience do you create in the process of doing this?
So we first have them come in and share their story with us, and then have a makeup artist come in and do makeup on them, put eyelashes, eyebrows, make them feel beautiful. During that process, we really get to know them as a person and ask them, what is your identity? Who do you say you are? Because we want to apply that onto their skin. And put that on their heads or on their arms or write down mantras or Bible verses to encourage them for the next 2 weeks and make them feel bold and strong and beautiful. And then once we do the crown, we'll have a photographer or videographer to capture those moments and, yeah, to share their story.
And you do a big reveal, right? They don't see what you're doing until everything is done, and then there's a big reveal moment?
Yeah, that's the best part. So, yeah, they're not allowed to see the makeup or the henna until we're fully done, and then we allow them to look in the mirror. And it's a really powerful moment for them.
Becky Richard, you were crowned last summer. At that point, where were you in your breast cancer treatment?
Well, I was about 4 sessions into my chemotherapy, and I had had a few months before a double mastectomy. So I was at a pretty low place in my life, and it was an incredible experience just to have someone who just sat me down and wanted to know about me and my life and my family and my journey and my faith. When you are diagnosed with cancer, your world is just swirling around you. It's just a devastating experience, and I describe it like living in a hurricane. And this experience was for sure the eye in my hurricane, because Amanda and the other artists were just able to just stop and really take the time and find out about me and get to know me. And it was a definite turning point in my healing.
How did it change for you?
Well, it changed because I was able to step away from all the medical diagnosis and treatments and the harshness of the medications I had to be on, the chemotherapy, my hair falling out, the nausea. I couldn't eat. I was weak. And just for those few hours, I was just able to sit still and relax and just remember who I was again. It was just wonderful.
And then when you had the moment where you got to see yourself in all of your hennaed beauty, what was that moment like for you?
You know, it was so special because it was the first time in a long time that I had felt beautiful. People that know me know that I don't have a self-esteem problem. I've always liked the way I look, but chemotherapy really, and a cancer journey in general, just really wears you down physically, emotionally, spiritually. So I was at a low point in my life, and seeing myself with my henna crown, it's really hard to describe. It was a wonderful moment.
And then over the next couple of weeks, while you had that henna crown so visible, what kind of response did you get when you're out and about?
You know, that was really the most amazing part to me. So one example, I was at the grocery store, and, you know, I chose to never wear a wig. So I would go about my, you know, days just bald, walking around, and I was pretty used to people glancing at me and then looking away nervously or giving me a look like they felt sorry for me. And that was, with my henna crown, it was exchanged to people coming up to me and saying, "Wow, you look beautiful," or "What is on your head? Is that a real tattoo? Is that temporary? Is that permanent? You look gorgeous. Wow, you're just glowing." So I got all of these compliments, and it really just opened up for people to come and talk to me. And I had these human connections with strangers that I didn't even know. And that in itself just was a nice little boost for me and helped me get through a really hard time in my life.
And we should note, Steve is the artist that also helps you do the crown.
Yes, yeah, he does the henna crowns with me.
And Becky, I know you're on the Crowns of Courage board now, so this certainly has left an impact on you, and you want to help further this work. But we also want to know, where are you now in your cancer treatment?
Well, I am fortunately nearing the end of my medical treatment, so I'm looking at possibly one more surgery for reconstruction, but it feels good to be rounding the corner.
Almost like rounding third base and heading toward home plate.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. I'm ready to take the next step.
Amanda, I know you've got Crowns of Courage. You are officially now a 501c3, so you are a nonprofit. What is your vision for Crowns of Courage? What do you want to do with this?
Well, our vision right now is to stay local and to kind of just grow it slowly. Obviously, we'd love to crown as many people as we can, but it does take the time and finding the makeup artists and making sure we have a videographer and help, because we really want to empower them by giving them a voice and sharing their story and allowing to be an awareness of a leader, of a goddess, and also of their cancer. And we do also do gatherings every couple months with the ladies who have already been crowned. So we create a community where they can constantly meet and encourage one another. And so we'd like to continue to do that. And then eventually down the road to be able to travel to other places and do it more.
How many have you crowned so far?
Probably over 60 people.
Okay. And I suspect there are henna artists that could be listening to you saying, this is great. I want in on this. So it is the kind of work that could certainly spread. And we'll encourage everyone, you can check out photographs of the women who've been crowned and learn more by going to the website Henna Crowns of Courage, all one word, hennacrownsofcourage.org. Amanda Joy Gilbert and Becky Richard, thank you so much for sharing this story with us. It is a beautiful story, and these photographs must be seen to be believed. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we hear from journalist Charlie LaDuff.
I know why we're doing puppy dog stories, because the founding fathers enshrined freedom of the press, but they forgot to enshrine a paycheck.
That is up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Here's just a sampling of what Detroit writer Charlie LaDuff has been up to in the past few years. Hanging out at the Mexican border, waiting for illegal immigrants to be ferried across on a jet ski. Spending time with conspiracy theorists at the Cliven Bundy standoff with the federal government. Trying not to get hit by rubber bullets or worse in Ferguson, Missouri. Getting tear gassed, assaulted, hassled. LaDuff sat down with Stateside's Lester Graham to talk about these experiences, which he chronicles in his latest book.
Charlie LaDuff, welcome. Nice to meet you.
And nice to be back in Ann Arbor.
Sounds like you had a good time for about 3 years there.
No, it was difficult. It was a really hard time in life. One, physically it's hard. You're sucking tear gas. You're traipsing through the desert at 110 degrees. You watch your country devolving and fighting it and being at each other's throats. And it was physically hard and it was spiritually dampening, but it was rock and roll. It was awesome.
So let's talk about what you were doing that got you into all those kind of situations. You struck a deal with Roger Ailes and Fox. Tell us what happened.
I was working at Fox, too, in Detroit. I wrote a book before this book. It's called Detroit, an American Autopsy. And the premise is Detroit's either a freaky outlier or it's the epicenter of the American direction. And I went into Roger's office and I asked him, let me take my two guys, Matt Phillips and Bob Schettelbauer, camera guys, and go around the country and put it to the test. So to his credit, he said, yeah, do it, which isn't a cheap proposition, you know, but we were on all the local stations that Fox owns.
That's 18 markets, right?
18 markets. Wherever there's an NFC football team, they actually own the station. You can figure out that's NFL football money. That's why they own them. So it wasn't partisan Fox. I worked for the New York Times for a dozen years. I get the liberals thing and the conservative thing. We just wanted to connect with regular people in their living rooms. And that's the...
The show was called, or the series was called, The Americans.
Yes.
What's the book called?
Shit Show. Or if you're going to edit that, it's S show, you know, S-H, what is that?
Asterisk.
Asterisk. Yeah. I always say apostrophe. Asterisk T. The country's collapsing and the ratings are great.
And I took a look at it. Those experiences were really, really interesting. But what did you want to let Americans know by writing this book? What was the message to them?
Well, First of all, I want to show you what's really happening, because TV is very superficial. It's not fake news. It's superficial news. But when you're in high school and you say, you know, she's so fake, you mean she's so superficial. I'm trying to show you, one, how the media works, how it works for itself and not for you. And then I'm trying to show you what's really going on and what we have in common. Like, what does Bundy have in common with Ferguson? They both believe the government works against them. In this country, at some level, almost to a person, we believe the government's failing us and doesn't work in our interests, but the interests of a very special few. And no matter where you go, what report you're looking at, what spreadsheet you look at, that's the truth.
You spent a lot of time talking about they versus us, and they is them, depending on who you are, whether it's class or race or whatever.
Political affiliation.
How do you get through that? How do you get past that they idea?
Me, as a reporter?
Yeah.
Oh, real simple. This is true from Iraq to China to California. You show up, you introduce yourself to the old people first, you let the kids hang on you because you're a stranger. You look somebody in the eye, you shake their hand, you state your business. Don't be a creep. Don't, as a reporter, don't circle around the edge. Take your shoes off when you enter somebody's house. Call somebody sir, not man. Food is offered to you. Take some of it. Don't be a pig and eat it all. It's universal. It's simple. Just be a human being.
You spend a great deal of your time talking to people who, frankly, are often overlooked by reporters. When do you know?
You mean the whole damn country, pretty much? Yeah.
When do you know this is someone we need to interview for the piece? I mean, you don't interview everybody you talk to, I assume. But how do you know when this is a guy or this is a woman I need to talk to?
I just get a feeling. For instance, when we're in Ferguson and everybody's using a telescopic lens, like, you know, basically look at the animals and they're stealing hair weaves and liquor, we're going in there. It's our country. We got to know what's going on in the darkness. And you'll be surprised what you find in the darkness. There's a young man named DJ, young black man, dark as obsidian, dreadlocked, muscular, masked, and has a piece tucked in his waistband. You know what he's doing?
Garden to meat store. Because I know that area because I worked at a radio station about 6 blocks from Ferguson. That's where I had lunch.
Get out.
And I know that meat store. So, yeah, I read that in the book. I thought, oh, yeah, because I went about 3 months after everything was going on to see what the city council was going to actually do in Ferguson as part of our reporting on race in America. And I'm looking around thinking, oh, man, that place was great. I can't believe it's gone. It was something else. But DJ was trying to
save it because he's from the neighborhood. So, you know, earlier in the day, about 10,000 black St. Louisans came. It was a victory in the sense that the hyper-militarized response by the police was stood down. They left. And it felt good. There's not a lot of wins in black St. Louis, you know? And ministers and old people and young people and teen, and it was like such a thing to be part of, kind of historic. And then darkness came. And the police are gonna say, okay, you want us to pull out? Okay, have at yourself. Nobody was there. We called 911 local. They kicked us to the county, who kicked us to the state, who kicked us back to the local. And it was sad. And there was DJ, a man amongst men, doing what I think most American men would do. This is not your neighborhood. This is not what this is about. This is definitely about something, but you're not the answer. You're ignorant. And this guy was a poet, and he did not put a bullet in anybody. He walked away.
I want to do a follow-up on DJ because he came back to the store and talked to the owner looking for a job. What happened?
Let's get real here. That's what this book is about, because there is no book that's real. There's no media that's real, and I'm trying to do that.
I'll beg to differ on that, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, give me one. I don't know it, like, I don't know. I don't think PBS is very real. I don't think broadcast news is real. I don't think the newspapers are very real. I think they read, like, term papers.
All right, let's get back to DJ and what happened.
Okay, but no, I'm going to finish that point.
Okay.
No, the media promised us that they missed us. They missed it. They don't understand what's going on in America. And they're going to double down since the election of Trump to figure it out. Will you tell me where they are? Because all I see is the split screen turning it into an octagon, and I see the newspapers copying the newspapers, and it's all in the White House. What about the real things? To DJ, he asked for a job. The owners are Arab. That's very specific and important in this country, and everybody knows what I'm talking about. He saved the store. They didn't have room for him there. That's a very real thing as well. That's a family business. They did not have a job for the guy. I knew it was a mistake because the second time around, when the grand jury decided not to indict the officer, I knew that thing was going to go up. As much as the owners tried to be part of the neighborhood and reach out, that was the opportunity. And that's the sort of the beef and the rub. Like, this happens in Detroit. Arab gas station owner, black citizen, white cop. What a strange triangle this is. That's what we're trying to get to. And hopefully we did.
And you did, because it's about racial divides. You talk about race in a frank and sometimes not politically correct. And then I get the idea that you don't really care whether you're politically correct or not. You just want to say what you see.
I'm trying to be correct, brother.
So what do you get that most white reporters don't get about dealing with race in our country?
I don't know. I'm mixed. You know, I'm mixed.
Your grandfather.
My grandfather's black. My grandmother's red. My great-grandfather's Jewish. You know, we're French-Canadian. You know, you put all that together, you know what you get?
Hybrid vigor.
Italian. That's right, Italian. I just learned long ago, like, it's quite simple. Be yourself. Don't be ignorant. You're asking questions because you want to know something. You want to learn. You want to grow. When I was coming out here to talk to you, I was like, what is liberal? What is conservative? What does that mean? What does that say about you when you call yourself one? You know, a guy will say, Tony Bourdain is a friend of mine, and he gives me a message on Facebook. He goes, you're the two baddest liberals I know, man. You're fair, you like life. And I'm like, well, we're fair and we like life. What is it about a conservative guy that you're not fair and you don't like life and we can't get along? I refuse to believe that stuff. I'm just a human. And what do I get? I get that you shake a man's hand, you say hello to his grandmother, you take your shoes off when you go to his house, and you hold your ground. Nobody runs you off of anything.
I want to get back to the TV journalists, because you were pretty rough on journalists in general, like you just started out a second ago. But you have a special attitude about TV journalists. What do you think the rest of us, are getting wrong?
Well, you're not a TV journalist.
Well, but you were critical of just about all the rest of the journalists.
Why wouldn't I be? I am one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
you got that right.
We are in... That's difficult. I think we're infecting the country. I think it's elite for sure. It's whether you're left or you're right, it's elite. And most of the country is not. And there's no real interest in getting down. Nobody likes a redneck. Nobody goes to his shooting range or his bar. Nobody reports the fact that twice as many white people get killed by police as black people. And it's not rich white people, you know, even though blacks are 1/5 of the population of whites. Or nobody ever really reports on the black experience unless there's a Katrina or a Ferguson or a shooting. And when you put the trailer park and the ghetto together, it's such a huge seat. In fact, when Dr. King was murdered, that's what he was trying to do, right? And the fact that whenever we talk about, let's say, the working class white experience, we only think he lives in Appalachia, but he lives right under the media's nose from Boston to Bakersfield. Like, how about taking off your brown shoes, the pancake makeup, the suit in front of a flooded out trailer park, and roll up your sleeves, do the hard stuff. For instance, Flint. The whole world's supposed to stop for a week because of Flint. It's still there. Nobody's come back.
I want to talk about, you seem to like baiting politicians, including Donald Trump when he was campaigning. Seems like you planted a few maybe seemingly ridiculous ideas and suddenly they became campaign promises. What is wrong with you?
Well, I like to look at it like this. One, I went to University of Michigan. It's nice to be here. Public dime. They taught me to read spreadsheets and do accounting and data analysis. I come with my work first. You don't see that in the stories because that's late night, you know, with a cigarette and a glass of wine in my basement for free. Then there's a way to present it. It's presentation. So Donald Trump knew it was an S show, like the book, S show. I knew it was an S show. He played it to its full potential. I played him. I need you, sir. I'm not even doing you. I need you as a prop to do my stories about the people. So knowing full well what he's doing in there, it's an S show. Why not? I'll do the S show too. Like I asked him 2 weeks into it if I could be his vice president at a press conference, which it's the only time I saw him and the media laugh together on anything. But it was perfect because in the book I say, you know, a lot of the things you say to regular Americans make sense in the fact that we're ailing. But you're not saying it right, dude. You're going to start a race war. You're not saying it right. So that's an edit point for me when he puts me down. nice edit point because I got your attention. It's the S show. I out S showed the S show guy. And now let's take a look at America, the reservation and the trailer park and the hood and the cul-de-sac and the McMansion and where all of us live. And we want something for our children. That's the main thing I found.
I want to talk about some stuff that reporters experience on a regular basis, but you had a funny way of dealing with it. Now, you got stopped by private security guards, Texas Ranger, federal law enforcement. If they had a badge, you got stopped and told you couldn't do what you were legally doing. I've run into that in every city I've worked in. What is up with that? It's a fairly simple concept. If you're on the sidewalk or on the street, you're on public property. Why do we keep having this experience over and over again?
Fight the power in that way. Stick up for your rights because the mall cop thinks he's got something on you. The plant security guy thinks he controls the highway out front. Like, get out of here. The Texas Ranger says I can't go down a public road where all the migrants are coming in because it's a national embarrassment, right? Me, I'm pushing back. I'm pushing back for my daughter. I'm pushing back for you. This whole $10 and a carry permit. I mean, man, get off me. We didn't even have press credentials.
I was going to ask you, because you did have press credentials.
We made them up.
You made your own, the news media press official identification. Tell them why you didn't have press credentials.
For some reason, the corporation doesn't issue them. Not for any nefarious reason. They just don't. In New York, you have to go to the police and get a background check, and then they'll give you official identification. Not in Michigan. So we never got them. But we're going to really heavy places. You're going to need something. So in lieu of that, what we did was took pictures of ourselves. You can see the cover there. I'm wearing a tank top. we took some, Fox logos and stuff. We put the news media official identification. We laminated it, and I cut out a snack cake barcode and glued it to it, put it on a lanyard, and voila, press.
I walked away from the book feeling that you have a fair amount of disdain for people in power and a fair amount of empathy for people who are struggling. And I'm wondering if you're conscious of that or if it's just you identify with the people, regular Joes and Janes, and you don't really even care or think about the people in power.
It's a good question, man. Pretty deep one. I love my people, and that's all of you. I do. And as Justice Hugo Black said, New York Times versus the United States of America, the Pentagon Papers, the press is to serve the governed, not the governors. And I have a lot of respect for public officials who do the job well and do it hard and don't do it to enrich themselves or their contributors. That's not a liberal or a conservative proposition. We need money in the public bank. And when you don't do it, and when I see children die because an ambulance doesn't show up, and I see a great big skyscraper going on downtown and there's not enough police, you won't pay for the officer's funeral that died in the line of duty because we don't have the money, but we're doing nonsense like that. Well, my mom expects that of me. My wife expects it. And when I pass on, I hope my daughter respects it. I hope that's what you want me to do. I have disdain for creeps and thieves and rip-off artists and cheaters. That's what I have disdain for.
I want to ask you to step back for a second.
Okay.
And tell me, what did you think of this whole national Fox News experience, this The Americans series? What do you take away from it?
I loved it, and I want to do it again, but I'd like a little more control, a little more help. I don't want to be told to back off the president, back off the governor. When you get too close, I don't deal well with that. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Puppy dog stories? And I know why we're doing puppy dog stories, because the founding fathers enshrined freedom of the press, but they forgot to enshrine a paycheck. That's why we have a surfeit of kiddies pushing yarn balls around. I don't blame the media for doing it, but listen, I know them. They're my friends. There's a lot of great, smart, brave reporters out there, thousands. But there's hundreds of thousands of piles of junk. And I'll just tell the listener, as you already know, it's up to you to find it. Where do I get my news? Watch this, how middle of the road I am. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, and the Associated Press. And even if the editorial pages are bleeding into the news stories, which they are, even there you can figure out what the facts are, cross-check them. And that's what I always did. And that's what everybody's doing, even far right and far left stuff. That's where they're getting their news. So let's not pretend like they're fake or they're useless or they're dead. No way. But they're going to have to get skinny. You're going to have to get rid of the national desk or your house and home. What, you're just going to have to pick what it is you do well and do that.
Charlie LaDuff is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who's worked at the New York Times, the Detroit News, Detroit's Fox 2 News. He's a Detroit's Gonzo-style reporter. That's fair, isn't it?
What does Gonzo mean?
Well, it comes from Thompson, doesn't it?
I looked it up. It means you participate. You put yourself in the story. Ah. So, okay.
His book is about the experiences he had while reporting for the Fox News series The Americans. And what's the title again?
Shit Show. The country's collapsing and the ratings are great. And thanks for reading it.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure, actually. It was a quick read. I looked at it, I thought, oh, how long is this going to take? And I read it in a day. So.
Yes! No, seriously. Look, man, a lot of people listen. I listen to you. So can I put that on the back of the paperback? That's cool.
Go ahead. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, brother.
And a note before we go. Today's show featured some interviews that aired previously on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening to Stateside.